Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who's been a journalist and a media critic for a long time, more than 20 years. He's former media critic for the Los Angeles Times and is chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek magazine. His name is Tom Rosenstiel, and he's here visiting the campus. He's going to take part in this year's Klein Symposium, which is an annual public affairs forum that's been going on now here on the campus since 1995. He'll be giving the keynote address tonight on the subject, Journalism, Elections, and Governing: Have Our Worst Fears Become Reality? That's tonight at 7:30. This is taking place in the Beckman Institute Auditorium. It's open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend certainly should feel welcome to stop by. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Tom Rosenstiel. Since 1996, he's directed the Project for Excellence in Journalism. That is a research institute that looks at the performance of the press. He also serves as vice chairman of the Committee of Concerned Journalists. That's an initiative that's interested in conducting national conversation among journalists about standards and values. He is also the editor and principal author of the annual report on the state of the news media, something that's put out by the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He's the author, co-author of a number of books, including The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect, Warp Speed, America in the Age of Mixed Media, and his newest, it's We Interrupt This Newscast, How to Improve TV News and Win Ratings, Too. He's also done writing for variety publications, Esquire, New Republic, New York Times, Columbia Journalism Review, Washington Monthly. And we're pleased to have him here on the program. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
One thing, well, there are a number of things I want to talk about, some of the issues that you deal with in the State of the News Media report. But just to pick one to begin with, let's talk about the declining audience for news. It's something that we see across the news business, in newspapers, in broadcasting, on cable, in radio. There seems to be the number of people who are really interested in the news seems to be shrinking. Or is it?
Not as much as we might have guessed, and not as much as a lot of people were predicting 10 or 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. There was a famous study done in about late 1980s that called The Age of Indifference, which suggested that younger people were not acquiring the news habit as they reached their late 20s and early 30s in the same ways that other generations had. And we now know, 15 years later, that the problem wasn't that they weren't interested in the world around them. They weren't interested in getting that information from traditional media. And the reason we know that this is the case is that these people do acquire news and information via the internet in much greater numbers than they do other media, and in numbers that are even higher than their elders. So another way of putting this is that all media skews old. Younger people don't acquire it, except online. And what is occurring, we now see, is that the new generation of Americans, and probably people worldwide, want what they want when they want it. They're on-demand news consumers. They're proactive. They're not passive. And it suggests a variety of other issues. And there are a lot of economic consequences to this. But the notion that the next generation of people have become insular and uninterested in the outside world turns out to be not the case. What they were uninterested in was having the sort of Walter Cronkite news agenda in which at the end of my telling you how the world is, I say, and that's the way it is, and you salute. They're not saluting that approach anymore.
Well, is it the case, though, that younger people, and I guess here we're particularly talking about, say, people under 20, but maybe we're even talking about people under 30 or people around 40.
Well, in my own case, it's number seems to be creeping up with each year, but yeah.
So there are obviously people, say, of our age who are still, you know, we still might sit in front of the television to watch CNN. We might turn on the radio to listen to All Things Considered. We're going to pick up the paper and read the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times, or hopefully people are also reading their local papers. Is it the case that younger people, they're interested in the same kind of content and that they're getting it online, or is it not the case that they're not reading the New York Times online? What they're reading something else online. If that is the case, then what's the something else?
Well, this is where it gets complicated, because if they go to someplace else, it's quite possible that what they're still getting is the New York Times. And the reason for this is that the number of outlets, that places that people can get and acquire information, has increased, you know, exponentially, an enormous explosion. Whether it's social networking sites and their friends and people emailing stuff to each other, or it's an actual destination. But the number of places that actually go out and gather news is quite small and has not expanded. In fact, has probably, in terms of boots on the ground, has shrunk, because the resources inside each of these institutions is under pressure. And so if I go to Google or Yahoo or MySpace or any number of other places, or Matt Drudge, what they're delivering is traditional journalism. What they're aggregating is wire services that were invented in the 19th century. And so we're discovering that people who may have no interest in and no particular affiliation to traditional brands of journalism are getting that kind of information. What we've also discovered is, and when I say we, I don't mean our group in particular, but what is also becoming clear is that even one of the concerns that people had was that with the internet, since you're your own editor, you're directing yourself, that what we think of as accidental news acquisition, where I just find out things by accident, you know, I turn on the news and I didn't know I was going to be interested in this, but I hear about it, that would disappear, that people would only drill down deep into a few subjects that they were interested in. That's not happening. There is accidental or incidental news acquisition. People who are quite young are still checking out the headlines, the top stories on Yahoo. They may have their My Yahoo page customized, but there is still an agenda setting that's going on. And so we know that the circulation of the New York Times is dropping, the circulation of the Chicago Tribune is dropping, the circulation of every newspaper is dropping. But there's another measurement that people are now using called total audience, which measures the print circulation and then the unduplicated online audience, the online audience that's not also reading the print edition. And for most newspapers in the country, their total audience is actually growing, and that's a new thing. We're seeing, in effect, the audience for the New York Times growing for the first time now in 15 years. And that's true of almost every newspaper in the country. And it's because there's a delivery system now that young people are willing to get. The problem is that the internet is not a very good platform for delivering advertising. It's not delivering revenue. So when you lose a reader from a print reader to an online reader, the economic effect of that is devastating. That's why newspapers are cutting back. It's not loss of audience per se. It's loss of a lucrative audience in favor of a less lucrative audience.
Yeah. Newspapers like the New York Times, they always could have told you how many papers they printed. That they might have had a more difficult time actually telling you how many people read them, because the assumption is that it's not one paper, one reader. Similarly, in the broadcast business, we in radio and television, the stations pay money to someone to tell them how many people are listening and watching, but we've never really quite believed that. and the people who do the ratings keep trying to come up with better systems so that they can more accurately say how many people are watching and listening, and are they actually paying attention? And at what points are they paying attention? And at what points are they zoning out? So there's, I think, all along, no matter what you're talking about, whether you're talking about print or broadcast, there's always been some question about the numbers we use to say what the audience was.
Absolutely.
And it seems like it's even now with more and more platforms, this is going to get more and more difficult to actually put a number on it and to say how many people looked at this page or how many people listen to the show or watch this show.
And this is a shock because people thought 10 years ago, oh, with the internet, that problem's going to disappear. We're going to know exactly how many people read an individual story. Well, it turns out 10 years later, not the case. There is differences in how you count page views. You can go to two different counting agencies and get two different numbers for unique visitors, the number of individuals who have looked at a page in the course of a month. These things shouldn't disagree, but there are drastic differences in the counting methods and some of the same problems and estimate problems that we have with TV ratings and how many people are Nielsen families and are they filling out the diaries accurately. Well, we've got similar kinds of problems, although they're digital problems, with the internet. And so we don't know now. There's a lot of disagreement about should we be counting unique visitors, should we be counting visits, should we be counting page views, should we be counting time spent online, how often does a page refresh, what do you do if somebody leaves a page open, what happens if they count, if they've got seven windows open, do we know that they're really reading it or not, are you allowed to count people during the day, what about people in different locales. So we're still in a state of mystery. It's less of a controversy right now because usage is growing online, and so people aren't fighting over which number is better because the numbers are still going up. But there's a lot of uncertainty, and we're not going to – and the advertising world, Madison Avenue, doesn't know what to make of all this because it's a lot of chaos on the internet.
Do you think that what news organizations are going to have to do is try to figure out some way to get people to pay for the content in the way that they haven't? And it seems to me that they also start off with the disadvantage that a lot of traditional news organizations, once they got into providing information on the internet, just took what they had and just put it up there. And they got people used to the idea that they were going to get it for nothing. And then when they tried to start charging, people said, "Well, I'm not sure I really want to pay for this." Is the way things are going, do you think it's going to have to be some kind of a pay per view arrangement?
Well, it's interesting to know the economics of the media business. Right now, of course, television is paid 100% by advertising, right? You don't pay to watch CBS. The only way they make revenue is from those ads for the purple pill. Newspaper business is about 20% of the revenue comes from subscriptions or circulation, and 80% comes from advertising. But there's different kinds of advertising. There's classified, there's national advertising, then there's what we call local retail, which is stores from your town. Online, there's no subscription, basically. And people have been unable to succeed in getting people to pay for the content. And the reason is pretty simple when you think about it. If you're the local newspaper, you're the only way I can get this information. But if I'm going through a computer, if you want me to pay for it, I can just go to the next place down the line. I don't have to move. I can just go to the next page, the next web destination. So news has become a commodity that's easy to get, and I can't charge you for it. The problem is that in a newspaper, you could have a full-page ad that's got a lot of information, and it's interesting. The advertising is a kind of content. People wait for the Sunday paper, and they get those inserts, and they flip through them, and they clip coupons. Advertising is content, and it's one of the things that people like about newspapers. There is no full-page display ad on the internet. The internet works more like the Yellow Pages, where if I want to find out about a retail operation, I don't need the news. I can go directly to the retailer. And so there's a disconnection going on between advertising and the news business, and that's why the pressure is growing. We've got to come up with some new economic model. to give you an idea, the New York Times makes 93% of its revenue from its print edition, but almost half of its audience is now online.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the question is, can we pay for it? Well, the prospects for pay are very difficult right now. And the reason is that the New York Times, for instance, had something called Times Select last year. They killed it in September. Why? Times Select was the thing where if you wanted the opinion columns of the New York Times and their editorials, things you couldn't get anywhere else except in the New York Times, you would pay a fee, $75 a year. Not a lot. And they were making money on it. They killed it, however, because they discovered that roughly two-thirds of the audience to the New York Times online now comes through the side door, through aggregators, blog links, me emailing my friends an editorial that I think is interesting or a story. And those people who come to the New York Times accidentally or end up there but weren't intending to go there, they're not willing to pay. If they hit the paywall, they say, well, forget it. I wasn't coming here on my own. Somebody just recommended this to me. I'm just going to move on. So they were losing more revenue in advertising potentially than they were gaining from subscription. So the prospects right now for pay really look dismal. And that's why everyone is saying that the internet and the media business generally needs to invent a new way of getting revenue. And it doesn't look like it's going to be subscription, at least not my getting you to pay for the content. It's going to have to be something else. Yeah. We can talk about what those options are, but it's not going to be a traditional subscription.
Well, let me just ask you a little bit of a different question, because also the internet poses a real challenge to small papers, local papers that have made some money off of selling classified ads. You know, now that we have Craigslist, who's going to put the ad to sell their whatever it is they've got to sell in their local paper when you can do that online and you can do it free and probably have a greater reach?
Classified advertising, you can't overestimate how important it was to the local newspaper. Roughly 40% of the revenue to most newspapers came through classified, a lot of it through employment classified and through people selling stuff. The selling stuff has disappeared to Craigslist, not all of it, but a big chunk of it. And the employment classified even more has disappeared to both Craigslist and to things like Monster.com, which are not associated with subsidizing journalism. So the effect of that has been devastating. In our report this year, we say that had classified not gone through this transition and you just had the other problems of advertising with retail, that of transitioning to online, that the problems of the newspapers would be pretty modest. It's this disappearance of classified to non-journalism sources, or in the case of Craigslist, to something that's completely free. It's just a bulletin board that has essentially become a major threat to journalism in America.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580, Tom Rosensteel. He's been a journalist for more than 20 years. He's former media critic for the LA Times, chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek magazine since 1996. He's directed the Project for Excellence in Journalism. That's a research institute that studies the performance of the press. He's editor and principal author of the Project's annual report on the state of the news media. He's authored or co-authored a number of books about journalism. He's written for a variety of publications, Esquire, New Republic, New York Times, Columbia Journalism Review. He's here visiting Champaign-Urbana to give a talk as part of the Klein Symposium. He'll be talking tonight about the current state of journalism at 7:30. This is at the auditorium of the Beckman Institute. Anyone's welcome. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked about the fact that it may not necessarily be that younger people are not interested in news. One thing that we know that is they are interested in getting it in perhaps in a different way than their parents or grandparents did, in terms of they want it when they want it, so they want immediacy. And they may also want it delivered in some kind of electronic form. And increasingly, there are ways to do that. You know, we certainly are now at the point where you can surf the web on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty small screen, but you can do it. And I think in future we can expect that there will be even more devices that will be, you know, wireless access to information is the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So so not only for younger news consumers is the interest in maybe getting it in a different way. Are they really interested in the same stuff? I mean, they may be getting information from some of the same news sources as their parents. But it must be that they also have different interests, and that gets back to the news organizations, and that has led them to change what it is that they do.
Absolutely. I mean, there was a socializing effect that went on when you were getting – when you read the newspaper, and you're a kid, and you start with the sports section or the Dear Abby column, and then you glance at other things on that page, and – people who your parents' age were putting together those pages and basically saying this is what's important, an agenda-setting role. Now, young people may be getting their news from their friends emailing them things, or I really think that before too long we're going to think of MySpace and other social networking sites as news delivery systems. People are going to put news on their wall. They're going to and their friends are going to be getting news, you know, person to person. And that's going to be customized and tailored very much to the interests and tastes of the individual. And news organizations are going to react to that. But we're also seeing something else, which is that online people can customize to their audience in such a way that they can also deliver a broader range of things. Our studies of internet news sites suggest that their news agenda is actually broader, more international, and more diverse than traditional media. Why? Because a news web page might have 30 or 40 links on it, whereas the front page of a newspaper can only have about 6. The network news typically is 9 stories. So I can put on my web page a wide menu of things, let people customize it, do some agenda setting within those groupings, and not have to pander quite so much because I can offer a wider range of things per page. The current thinking about web design is that 50% of any page, even an interior page, 50% of the real estate should be devoted to helping people navigate to other things. And that means that I can offer you a wide range of things and I don't have to worry. I don't have to be the e-entertainment network and target you quite as precisely as I did in the old media where I've got to really sort of lure you and grab you. And I've got a limited shot at doing that.
Yeah. Right. We got several calls. In fact, the lines are full, so the callers can help us by trying to be brief. But we certainly want to hear what people have to say. We'll start in with someone in St. Charles, and this is line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Great topic. I just wanted to say I think the reason, one of the biggest reasons why this is you know, the internet growing thing is for news is that there's more information of certain topics. Now, for instance, I'm on the internet now, and you're talking about certain papers. Well, there's a couple of papers I have here that I'm pulling up that don't have the information from some other topic on another, you know. In other words, papers, newspapers are limited to how much paper or how much information they can put on it. They kind of pick and choose certain, you know, subjects to talk about. And I think with the internet, because I can, I'm finding stuff that I wouldn't find in a paper on the internet, basically. It is news media oriented. There's a lot more research, I think, being done on the internet on certain topics, like, for instance, some of the candidates, than you would get in a paper. Because they're limited to how many how much paper they can print out.
There's another,
and I think that's a big deal right there.
Yeah.
There's another element to that which I think is also important, and that is that it doesn't have to disappear each day. If you've got something significant, you can keep it in an archive, people who want to sort of research something or miss something that happened a week ago or a story that was important that ran a week ago. It's not thrown away into garbage bags at the end of the day the way it was in the era of the print newspaper. So the caller is absolutely correct that it's a richer well that they're going to on the internet, even if I, as the user, am targeting what I want. The chances of my brushing up against something is actually in some ways greater because what's in there, the number of links, not just on a page but in that website, are almost infinite.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could here, just to take this as an example, now with the internet, you could have the opportunity to read newspapers from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
You could read newspapers all day long.
Right. If I go to Google News and I Google in a topic or just go to the Google News page, there'll be 2,000, on average, 2,000 stories in English on whatever the event is that I might want to read about. Many of them are the same AP story, but nonetheless.
Well, that I guess I'm going back to this question about how many people are reading content that was generated by a traditional existing news organization. So it's news magazine, a newspaper, could be CNN.com, could be something like that. And something that maybe would have existed or does exist in print form. And how much is alternative, non-mainstream sources? There are lots and lots of blogs, and anybody can essentially create a site and put on there whatever they want. Do we know what do we know about alternative versus traditional sources and their how much attention they're getting?
It's surprising, actually. If you take all the blogs and alternative news sites that relate to sort of politics, just as an example, which is one study I saw done, and you take the traditional news, newspaper news sites, and compare their audience sizes, the traditional sites are 300 times larger in audience than the alternative sites. The traditional sites have a larger share of audience online than they did in the traditional media. Mm-hmm. For instance, the top 10 newspapers in print command 19% of the audience of all the circulation in the United States. Online, those top 10 newspaper websites command 29% of all the newspaper web traffic. So the big are getting bigger online, and we're augmenting that with blogs and everything else. But that long tail is so diverse and so fragmented that its total audience doesn't really compare. It's a spice, but the entree is still, at this point at least, traditional news.
Mm. Next is Champagne and line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd like you to discuss what I see as the crisis in mainstream journalism today. and, you know, this is one of the reasons why some people are turning away from it. But, I mean, I can't even watch you know, the network news anymore on television. It's just, you know, it's useless, worse than useless. And, you know, when you see what ABC did with the last presidential debate, I mean, that's pretty disgusting, too. We're very ill-served by that. I find myself even having a lot of problems with, you know, the PBS Lehr report. you know, I still like Bill Moyer's journals and things like that, but I'm more turning to Democracy Now! And Free Speech TV now that I've gotten rid of cable and gone to satellite, and, you know, using online sources as well. But, you know, we know that in 2000 the presidential election was essentially stolen. There's lots of evidence that it was stolen in the last presidential election, yet, you know, there's no real examination of that in the mainstream media. It's as if these things never happened, and there's you know, the coverage of the Iraq war has gone down to just a tiny fraction of, you know, news coverage. There's just, you know, if you compare what we get in this country to what people in other countries get and their mainstream media, we're just very poorly served. I mean, you look at Canada, you look at, you know, Europe, even Israel. I mean, there's much more diversity of viewpoints than there is here.
Well, it is true that the model that's used, not so much in Canada, but in Europe and most of the rest of the world, is more of a ideological press model in which a given newspaper or magazine represents a particular party or point of view. And most of those countries are geographically much smaller than the United States also. And so most of the outlets are national, and it's fairly common for people to be exposed to and read multiple publications with conflicting points of view. Part of that reflects, I think, the parliamentary system that you have, where you have multiple parties, not two parties, but five, six, seven parties in most of these European countries, as well as Israel. And so those cultural differences and the geographic differences lead to a completely different economic model. In most of those countries, they make almost all their money from people buying the newspaper, not from advertising. In this country, our newspapers are local. There's one in every town. You don't have a lot of the notion that let's say in most cities that you'd have a liberal and a conservative newspaper isn't plausible, because even one newspaper is having a hard time sort of surviving economically. So there are a lot of reasons that the model is different in the United States. In terms of people becoming more skeptical and less satisfied, there's no question. The ability of the old media to force feed us their agenda is gone. But the ability for us to get sort of original reporting on things from bloggers and alternative media is still quite small. You know, there aren't – if you want to find out what's going on at the White House, you still need somebody who's got a traditional camera and a press pass and is doing conventional news gathering. And that's still – that sort of initial presentation of facts and events is coming from traditional sources.
Well, I think that, you know, part of the – what I see is the crisis of democracy or dwindling – very marginal democracy in this country is in part, no small part, due to how bad our corporate media is. And I mean, we really have a corporate, very limited corporate view today in the media. And in as far as parties, you know, I mean, there's some differences, but it seems like we've got one party with two different wings, and they both have a corporate agenda. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. It does seem to be the case that people's generally, and this kind of call does not surprise me, and certainly whenever we talk about media, we hear from people who appear to be conservative who say that the mainstream media is too liberal, and people who appear to be liberal who say the mainstream media is too conservative, and a general, I think, overall unhappiness of people with content,
yeah,
and feeling that there's not enough there, you know, there's not enough meat there. Do you think that dissatisfaction with the media, is that at a higher level than it has been in the past?
Yeah, we know it is. We you know, these surveys have been tracking public attitudes towards the media since the early 1980s, and there's just been a steady sort of growing disaffection, a lack of believability, by almost every measure, and that's been measured many different ways. Is the press moral? Is the press helping democracy, et cetera? And those metrics are all declining. What we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years in particular is a growing ideological split, where people see a political bias. Conservatives see a liberal bias, and liberals see a corporate bias and a kind of innate conservatism in the press. That is added to by the financial crisis, which is causing almost every news organization in the country to cut back on resources because their audience is fragmenting. And as their audience fragments, their revenue declines. And so, you know, you've got half as many people working at the network news divisions as we saw 15 years ago. That materially impacts what is on the air. And if there are biases in the work that the people there are doing, they're going to be more exposed by the fact that they're more rushed, they're spread thinner, You know, your whatever professional discipline you have as a journalist is undermined by the financial cutbacks. Your unconscious biases are going to come out and spill into the work more when you're rushing. Yeah. And so I think these things feed on each other. And then you add in the dimension that people have other alternatives and they say, wow, there's another way to look at this. It's not just the AP writing style. It's the trifecta of forces: limited resources or declining resources, growing disaffection and political polarization, and then a growing ability to see other alternatives and see the further the weaknesses in what you're getting.
Let's talk with someone here on a cell phone, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'm a grad student at Illinois, but I did my undergrad at Missouri. And the J School of Missouri had a project that may still be going where they take the Missourian, which is the local paper, and then they have a PDF version of it. And I've never read newspapers, but I found that I tried it out and for probably a few months, read this PDF edition, and it was beautiful. It was, you know, you could view it full screen, and it was so aesthetically, it was uncluttered, and it was, you know, I could carry it with me because I had my laptop with me, and it was, and because it was PDF, it was very controlled in terms of, you know, websites tend to have a lot of extraneous stuff, but this was pretty much all the whole page was just content, and then you press page down to take the next page. And they also had full page ads, which were really cool because it was, you know, nostalgic. But I could see myself being very interested in this sort of a layout, say in local newspaper, except of course we don't have someone to edit it. And then I would be seeing the full page ads. So I'm curious, what do you think about alternative file types as opposed to all web-based?
Yeah, I think there's growing interest in this as people discover that the economic model isn't working on a traditional computer screen. That experiment is still going on at Missouri, but it's still in the laboratory stage. Another technology that is in the wings that hasn't evolved too far is the foldable sort of web screen. It's like paper. It rolls up into a scroll, and you can unwrap it and carry it around, and it can wirelessly receive the newspaper. The problem is it's a roll, and it's fragile, and the technology hasn't developed. But, you know, it may be, as we're scrapping around for a new economic model, that it's going to be a new delivery system other than the static laptop screen. Or it also may be, clearly we're going mobile and we're going wireless. And there is a point at which I think one will say, this screen's too small. My phone may not be the ideal delivery system to watch the events of the world unfold in real time.
Well, and it's interesting because actually there was some researchers at Illinois who recently came out with some sort of a wire that can stretch, or a conductor that can stretch. And one of the major applications was screens that you could stretch or unfold that were very, you know, structurally able to handle that.
Yeah, I think that's the key. It's got to be something that's so durable. And can really be essentially close to folded. It's got to be something you could slip in your pocket and then somehow unroll, and we're not there yet.
Right. Great, thanks.
All right, thank you. I should, for anyone who might have tuned in recently here, better introduce again our guest. We're talking with Tom Rosensteel. He is former media critic for the Los Angeles Times, chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Since 1996, he has directed the Project for Excellence in Journalism. That's a research institute that studies the performance of the press. And also, he's the editor and principal author of their annual report on the state of the news. He has written for a variety of publications. His writing has appeared in a variety of publications: Esquire, New Republic, New York Times, Columbia Journalism Review, Washington Monthly, and has authored or co-authored a number of books about the practice of journalism. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll give a talk tonight on the current state of journalism. This is part of the Klein Symposium tonight, 7:30 at the auditorium of the Beckman Institute. It's open to anyone who is interested. And here on the program, we'll take as many callers as we can. We have about 10 minutes left, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Up next, the caller is in Pasotum, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I made an observation. I've been getting subscriptions to Time and Newsweek for an extremely low price. I guess I'm in the senior citizen age group. But I get these year subscriptions for $12. And to me, the postage and everything involved that would to deliver this to my home, obviously they're not making money on the selling of magazines and frequently. I'm wondering what the breakdown is for corporate advertising for their profit compared to the buyer buying the magazine, either through subscriptions or through whatever. And if it is highly slanted toward the advertising of corporate interest, is this slanting our news considerably because they have to be continuously conscientious of the points of view that they put in their magazines? That's one point. And the second point is, of course, these magazines are entirely on their ratings and how much they can sell of their particular magazine in one way or another. But the emphasis on emotionally laden articles that are more superficial rather than have any substance to them so that they can get, sell more magazines or get more coverage for their advertisers. I'd like to hear your comments on that. Thank you.
Sure.
Well, the magazine business is really a diverse business now, and the economics of niche magazines is very good. In other words, if you were reading left-handed skateboarder magazine or, you know, magazines about tennis or magazines about some particular hobby, those niche publications are really thriving. And the reason is there's a high demand. People are willing to pay a pretty good freight for the subscription. The advertisers know that there's a strong loyalty to the, and there aren't a lot of magazines in each of those areas. Where another area in the magazine business that's thriving is elite magazines. The Atlantic, The Economist, The New Yorker, all doing really well. Why? Because the readership is loyal, is grateful to have sort of long-form journalism that's serious-minded. What's suffering is the mass publication. Time and Newsweek are giving those publications away and are basically having a very hard time meeting their promise of readership that they guarantee to their advertisers, and that business is really, really suffering. The theory behind newspaper magazine economics is that if you have enough different advertisers, you're not beholden to any one of them. But that business, the mass magazine business, is in such trouble that I don't know what the future holds for them. So the magazine business is a niche business now, and if you can find the right niche and a loyal audience, you can go very rich, very deep, write long form, and the future is pretty bright.
Yeah, I want to thank the caller again because we're kind of short on time. I'm going to Edgar County for another caller, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I first of all have to give in full disclosure that I'm an accredited member of the Public Relations Society of America, and I taught public relations at NYU and Pace and worked in New York media. But did you read the New York Times? In reading the New York Times yesterday, they had a major story on the military advisors retired and their being used by the Pentagon. Did you read that?
Yeah. That was a major expose that the Times.
I thought that was appalling.
Yeah. For just a review for your listeners, it was a very long piece, probably two, three open pages inside the Times, jumped
right.
Lead story in the Sunday paper that said essentially that the TV commentators, the military consultants on the networks and the cable channels, were co-opted, given access and given talking points by the Pentagon, to basically counteract the reporting that was on the ground from the media in Iraq, and was a massive and carefully orchestrated spin job, and has been for the duration of the war, and that even some of the generals who were part of it have become alienated by the level of manipulation that's engaged there.
Well, I knew something had to be going on because I listened to all variety of programs and do a lot of reading. And I thought that was just one of the most despicable.
And one of the things that comes across in the piece, and I think is a point where the press really needs to take a deep look, is that the news organizations themselves had virtually no awareness of this. They never even asked these guys, what affiliations do you have? What corporate affiliations do you have that might give the Pentagon leverage over what you say? They were just booking these guys to get them on the air and look good. And there was no due diligence on the part of the news organizations that were putting these guys forward as their military advisors.
Going on in other areas, putting out the public service announcements and the Agriculture Department and such over the years. It's in both administrations, you know.
Yeah,
not just one.
Right. I think literacy messages may be a little different than what than the Pentagon spin.
This is a little more deadly.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, I just wanted to alert people that they can probably get it online.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up because it's very important.
All right.
Well,
thank you so much.
Well, and this also maybe leads to a question about anyone who is offered up or offers themselves up as some kind of independent voice, whether we're talking about commentators, analysts, bloggers, you really have to ask the question, is that person truly an independent voice? Because various kinds of parties who have various kinds of interests have deliberately employed bloggers as a way of getting a particular viewpoint on a particular subject out there in front of the public.
Right. The flip side of this disaffection with traditional media that we're talking about is that this alternative media is a kind of Wild West. These people are not necessarily citizen bloggers. They may be on the payroll of various forces. And the dirty little secret of the information revolution is that most of it is about repackaging and commenting on the news, not actually going out and gathering it. Mm-hmm. So the number of voices we hear may be greater in number, but we really don't know who these folks are. The one good thing about traditional journalism was there was a kind of socialization that you would be independent. Now, maybe the independence that journalists acquired created its own biases, but these people were not in the control of one force or another that they were covering. At least they aspired to a kind of neutrality. Whether they achieved it or not is another matter.
Yeah. Something I think is really interesting is that on the web we now have organizations that have sprung up that are essentially blogger aggregators that are organizing themselves kind of like the news magazines that we have seen. That's what the Huffington Post.
Yeah. Huffington Post is the number one blogging destination on the internet. And it's not one blogger. It's a kind of a Ariana salon of bloggers, most of whom are – none of whom is paid, and most of whom are sort of celebrity dilettantes. You know, like Rob Reiner wants to blog about politics, so he's on Huffington Post.
We're trying to get one more caller here in Urbana where we are, line one. Hello.
Early in the program, you talked about the possibility of options beyond subscriptions and classified and so forth, but you never got back to tell us what those are. Would you please do that?
Thank you.
Good
thank
point.
You for the question.
In cable, you pay a subscription, whether you play golf or not, to the Golf Channel, to the Food Channel, and all those other channels that are on your cable system. You don't know it because it's embedded in your cable bill. That is a model that I think is going to be explored in the not so distant future. The reason is that the Earthlinks and Comcasts of the world have a vested interest in the news business surviving. It's a big part of what makes the internet appealing to people. And they know, as does Google, that if the news business shrinks, their business will shrink along with it. And so we are marching slowly and grudgingly toward a system in which the AP and the newspaper industry, I think, is going to go to these internet service providers and say, basically, build our fee into your fee and pass it along to us. It's going to require some congressional action. It's going to require some antitrust work and some other things. But that increasingly is the model that I think insiders think has the most potential.
We're just about at the point where we have to finish here. I guess, though, the thing I find myself wondering is if you could get people used to the idea of paying $2, $3 to download this week's episode of Desperate Housewives, whether you could also then get them used to the idea that you want to read the New York Times. Okay, well, you can download today's edition for a quarter. Or, you know, something like
that. That's what people thought was going to happen. The problem is there's only one Desperate Housewives, but the New York Times isn't really that different from the Washington Post. Yeah. And so that's why news has become this commodity that I can get anywhere. And the marginal difference of the Times isn't enough for me to be willing to pay for it when the other is free.
Yeah. Well, at that point, we'll have to stop. Our guest, Tom Rosensteel, he is a former media critic for the L.A. Times, chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek. Since 1996, he's directed the Project for Excellence in Journalism. That's a research institute that looks at the performance of the press. They do indeed have a website. You want to find out what they're all about?
Journalism.org.
And he is here to give a talk. He's here as part of the Klein Symposium. This is an annual public affairs forum that began here on this campus in 1995. This year, looking at journalism, adding light or just turning up the heat, the challenge of democracy in the age of new media. I'll be talking about journalism today, tonight at 7:30. This is the keynote address. That's in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute on the U of I campus, and it's open to the public. Anybody is welcome. Thanks very much.
That was a pleasure.